Where I make wine, I like to push the limits of where grapes ripen.
People just need to trust their own palate and not be concerned about what a critic says or what they read in the paper.
As a master sommelier, I mean, for me, at this point in my life, I'm kind of more in the Yoda stage.
My dad used to say when I was a little kid that the best wine you'll ever have is one you want to have another glass of.
I had a moment when I realized the power of wine. One day at a dinner, a bottle of Mouton Rothschild 1955 was opened and it just like silenced the whole table.
I'm so happy when a friend of mine sells a bottle of wine. And I love to brag about the wines that are being made by our friends because I'm so proud of them.
Farming is agricultural warfare.
I can't imagine doing anything else.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 169.
And this week we talked to Richie Allen, Director of Viticulture and Winemaking for Rombauer Vineyards in Napa Valley. In Napa Valley, you can find winemakers from France, Denmark, Switzerland, Italy, Croatia, Spain, just to name a few. For this podcast, we talk with Richie Allen, Director of Viticulture and Winemaking for Rombauer Vineyards, and he is from Australia. Richie has been in the U.S. for quite some time and has made Napa Valley his home. We spoke with Richie by phone just last week, learning a bit about his techniques and thoughts on winemaking. I'm here with Richie Allen, and Richie is the Director of Viticulture and Winemaking at Rombauer Vineyards in Napa Valley. Richie, how you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. It sounds like you have a lot going on at the vineyard this week.
It's a end-of-year wrap-up, so always busy.
Yeah, I imagine. And, you know, you're not really too far off the heels of harvest. I guess maybe you are because it was early harvest this year, right?
Yeah, we've been wrapped up for a little while. We've, you know, got a few niggling ferments that, you know, want to... Not show us the love is what I call it, but, you know, we're pretty close to totally wrapped up.
Good. Well, that's got to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah, it's when you finish for the year, it's always a good feeling, especially after a year like this. It was a very, very compressed year this year.
Well, I guess it's a bit like putting your babies to bed, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I just, you know, we had a big vintage the previous year, so we had a lot of wine in the bottle. And then with the port strikes and getting, you know, your corks and your labels and things like that, and we started bottling late, then an early harvest, and it just became a sprint to the end. I'll put it that way.
I never even thought about that, the port strikes. Rather ironic term, I might add. That really did mess you guys up, huh?
Yeah, a lot of wineries struggled, getting corks into the country, getting wine barrels into the country. You know, a lot of the paper stocks for wine labels come from overseas. You know, Tin Foils, one of the largest foil companies in the world, they come from France. So, you know, when you think of wine, it's a global industry, and, you know, things come from, you buy from different manufacturers around the world. You know, a lot of winemaking equipment comes from Europe. We didn't buy any new equipment this year, luckily, but, you know, everything was stuck in the port, literally.
Really. Yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't realize that bottles came from Europe.
Bottles, yeah. A lot of our normal, regular bottles, but a lot of our high-end bottles for our high-end products made in France.
I'll be doggone. Well, there you go. I learned something new.
Yep.
Okay, we're done. See ya. Bye. Anyway, I want to come back to talking about harvest in a couple of minutes, but first things, of course, I want to point out that you obviously have an accent, and you're from Australia, if I'm not mistaken?
That is correct, yep.
And what part of Australia?
Originally, I'm from Melbourne.
So you were relatively close to a winemaking area then when you grew up.
Yeah, I mean, we're on the eastern side of Melbourne in the suburbs, and I was about 25 minutes from the Yarra Valley, and you know, that's some of the first wine region I ever went to go wine tasting was the Yarra Valley, and I ended up working there for a while, and yeah, I mean, wine's just become part of my life.
How old were you when you did that first time up there?
First time up there, you see, in Australia, the drinking age is a lot lower than it is in America. I was 19.
So, yeah, I imagine that contributes to people not being quite so hung up on alcohol down there.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a different culture and probably more similar to Europe, where not that alcohol is dismissed in any way as being, you know, laissez-faire in terms of its control, but it's, in Europe, wine is part of food. In Australia, we have a large European influence. We have a lot of European immigrants who are now, had children, and their children have had children, and alcohol it's just perceived in a different way to how it is in the U.S.
Was this a moment when you went to vineyards? Was there a moment that was like, wow, this is something I'd like to do, or this is something that interests me, or just a pure love of wine?
Actually, no. When I was in university, I was doing biological science with a major in genetics, and I took a year off, which is really, really common in Australia. Nearly every one of my friends, we call it deferring for a year. You get into your degree, start your major, and you'll take a year off and go on sabbatical. And Australia being so far away from everything, usually when you leave the country, you leave for quite a while.
Yeah, I bet.
So I took a year off. I was big in the rock climbing and still am. And me and my best mate, we came to California on our first stop to go rock climbing. And some friends in Sacramento took us wine tasting in the Sierra foothills in Amador. And that sparked my interest. And when I got back to Australia, I was like, all things wine. Wine. So I finished my degree and went straight into a winemaking degree at the University of Adelaide. And when I finished, got a job as a winemaker in Australia. And part of building experience as quick as you can is, going and doing vintages in the Northern Hemisphere because the seasons are the opposite. And I really wanted to come back to the Napa Valley, which I visited the first time I was here after Amador. And I went through a visa exchange company and they got me a job at Rombauer. And the rest is history.
Ironically, you ended up there.
Yep, it was a good place to land, and I've left a few times. I won't lie, I've quit my job at Rombauer more than once, and had a better offer back in Australia or New Zealand. But I think the longest I've been gone is 8 months before Mr. Rombauer would call me and say, "Hey, we've got a job for you now. Come back." So
nice.
So I always came back.
Have you wanted to move back permanently to Australia, or?
No, my wife's over here now. My wife's from Melbourne, Australia. We met studying genetics, and she loves it over here. And we have a little girl now. We call her our little Yankee because she was born over here.
There you go.
And bought a house. And I've worked for corporate wineries. I've worked for family-owned wineries, but I can't say I've ever worked for anyone quite like the Rombauers. And they have an amazing way of holding on to staff. And I've been here almost 12 years now, and I'm still relatively new, not sort of till you hit 17 to 25 years that you're a long-term employee at Rombauer. So,
I think you have to get like 40 years to be considered officially as a resident of Napa Valley, right?
Probably. Yeah. But like we have like one of my cellar guys, Keith, who's from Oklahoma, whose nickname is Oki. He started at Rombauer 27 years ago.
Wow.
And it's just, you come here and they look after their staff, and if you work hard, they look after you, and it's a great place to work. They let us make the wines exactly how we would want to make them, and they let us do our jobs, which is great.
That's very much typical of what I see in Napa Valley. The whole idea of family is such a big deal. Obviously, blood family as well as people who are employees, long-term employees, it's very common there. It amazes me. It's very cool. You're lucky.
Yeah, it's somewhat, I guess, unique to the wine industry. And, I mean, at the heart of it, the wine industry, they're really farmers. Right. And farmers, they have to ride with the seasons and the change in the times, and they have a very long outlook on how business is progressing, I guess.
And being a winemaker is not a typical commitment, especially harvest, but let alone travel you might have to do, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky, like we do very little travel as winemakers. Like I have friends who are corporate winemakers who spend probably a week a month traveling for work. And I'm lucky if I spend more than 2 weeks a year out on the road, it's unusual. The Rombauers very much like us to focus on literally, and this is exactly what it is, just make the best wines you can. And so they let us focus on that. And a lot of those, marketing things, events, the Rombauer family does that, which is great, and they're fantastic at it.
That's great. That's very impressive that they, give you that kind of autonomy.
Oh, yeah, it's nice, actually. Don't get me wrong, meeting customers, and we do local events that are, in the Bay Area and things like that, and it's great to meet customers, but I can't imagine given the way we make our wine and the level of expertise and how involved the winemakers are in the winemaking process and how hands-on we are, I can't imagine spending a week, a month away from the winery. It just, we wouldn't be making the wine in the quality that we are if we had to do that.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that because that would be a great challenge, and especially with some of the travel being pretty extensive, you have to kind of screw your head back on when you get back. So here you're there.
Yeah. Like I was away for a week at the end of November, and in a different time zone. And it was, I think I spent more time on my laptop and on my phone back to California checking on things. It's an uncomfortable feeling. I'll put it that way.
Well, like I said, it's they're your babies. You put them to bed. The grapes are sleeping or working or whatever they're doing.
Yep.
One thing that fascinates me, especially because you're from Australia, is it a really major different way of going about making wine in California, in Napa, versus what you did in Australia?
I've got a good analogy for that. In Australia, if you work, most of the wineries are either very small family-run wineries, and I mean very small, or they're medium to large wineries and quite often corporately owned. And you make wines across a series of tiers. So, you'll have your reserve wines, which get all your love and attention, and they're what you're super passionate about. Then you have your everyday wines, and you might be making some private labels for a supermarket. And you basically, at the end of the day, you're always trying to hit a cost per gallon. So you have so many dollars per gallon you can spend to make a wine for a particular price point. Whereas specifically at Rombauer and even the Napa Valley, the difference is it's make the best wine you can, period.
I guess that's when you've got a reputation like Napa, you really have to keep that up.
Yeah, and there's probably more high-end, I think there's more high-end wineries selling wine and have the ability to make wine at a high level than any other region in the world. It's Napa Valley is, it's truly unique in that respect.
I've gotten to drink a lot of that wine. I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, the level of investment in the Napa Valley, the quality of the farming, the quality of the farming land, the climate we have. I mean, there's places that come good and are very, very close. And, they'll have icon wineries within that region. But Napa Valley as a whole is, I think, a true anomaly worldwide. Like, it's just the amount of high-quality wine here is exceptional.
Yeah, it is amazing what's made out there and the standards. And I love the fact that you're constantly going back to talking about farming because, making wine is all about farming. You are a farmer in essence.
Yep. And, I think the thing I hear a lot at the moment from winemakers, I spend all my time in the vineyard. And that's great. Spend all your time in your vineyard. But it's only half the story. And, we divide our time fairly evenly between our vineyards and the winery. They're both, I think, as equally important as the other. You can't make great wine without great grapes. But if you're not taking care of the wine once it's made, all that effort you put into growing the grapes is a complete waste of time. So, it's a two-pronged attack.
Sure. Yeah, there are steps involved. I'm going to rephrase my question here. Are you a state or are you a little bit of both?
We're about half-half. So about half of our fruit comes from vineyards that we own, and the other half is from growers who we have long-term relationships with. So to give you an example, Rombauer Chardonnay, we have a handful of very core growers, and everyone wants to know what the secret is with Rombauer Chardonnay. And I'd say one of the secrets is we've found growers who want to work with us long-term, and it's a partnership. And one of those growers that we work with extensively and have been for probably over 20 years now is the San Giacomo family in Canaris.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's all about getting the same fruit from the same high-quality vineyards and consistent farming and being able to work with the growers to make sure they're producing grapes at the level that you want and go as hard as you can.
Yeah, that makes sense. Other than Carneros, are there a number of different areas that you're sourcing grapes from for your Chardonnay? And I know, as an aside, that you guys are quite well known for your Chardonnay.
No, it's all Carneros. So Carneros is where we focus on specifically for Chardonnay. And where Rombauer is somewhat unique compared to other wineries is we're very much focused on regionally specific varietal wine. So if you look at our Chardonnay, it comes from Carneros. That's where we feel is the best place to get Chardonnay for our style of wine. If you look at our Merlot, it's the bottom end of the Napa Valley, a lot of Carneros, a lot of Coombsville because it's a little bit cooler. If you look at our Cabernet, it's almost exclusively a little bit further up valley and on hillsides. And if you look at our Zinfandel, it's predominantly old vine Zinfandel from Amador and El Dorado County, which is not even Napa. And that's because that's where the best varietals are suited for those particular wines.
I'm just smiling at every area you mentioned because I'm running it through my head.
Yeah, no worries.
You know, we're looking at the 2015 harvest. I want to go back a couple steps here to the what everybody called the dreaded 2011 vintage, which I personally disagree. I thought there were some amazing wines in 2011. Well, you know, I'm sure it was a challenge for you with all the rain.
Yeah, I mean, 11 was, I'd say, probably a very technically challenging year. And you really had to start at the start of the season, knowing the season was cool and late, and start your work in the vineyard. If you were trying to come back, you know, in the last month before harvest and fix problems in the vineyard, it was too late. You were, you know, 4 or 5 months too late. And we saw how late it was. We saw how cool it was. And we were already making adjustments, like, as soon as the growing season began. And that saved us. That meant we could get our fruit ripe. We could get it into the winery. You know, it was an expensive year. I got yelled at a few times from Mr. Rombauer when he saw what I was spending out in the vineyard. But at the end of the day, we were able to make wines that tasted good, whereas a lot of our competitors weren't.
You know, now you're standing up against 12, which was, as everybody say, the amazing vintage of the decade or whatever period.
I think 12, 13, 14, I call them the trifecta. Like, it's pretty rare that you get three vintages like that in a row in your career. And I hope it happens again.
Well, and then you had 15, which was a bit of a crapshoot.
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say, once again, the 15 was early. We had some during flowering, which is, you know, a very key time for crop set. We had some cool weather. And then from then on out, it was all about what you did in your vineyard. And if you were paying close attention, you did fine. And like the quality of the Cabernet and the Chardonnay we have, I mean, it's on par with, I think, 14 or 12 easily. So, you know, if you know what you're doing and you can roll with the punches, the one thing I really find frustrating that I see in every part of the world is this is how we do it, period. And rather than going, right, this year we've got this, we need to adjust. And if this happens, we adjust. And if this happens, we adjust. And if you work on that mantra, you can definitely make good wine every year. But if you go, well, 8 years out of 10, we have good weather, so this is how we do it. When a challenging year comes along, you're gonna struggle.
That's a good point because, I mean, we all adjust to Mother Nature. And as a farmer, you have no choice.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people try and fight it. Don't get me wrong. It's all everything with winemaking is knowing what all the techniques are and knowing when to use them. And whether that's in the vineyard or in the winery, it's all about knowing when to use a technique at the appropriate time. And, you know, it takes a long time to build that experience. Mm. You need to, one of, I think, the greatest things that's happened probably in the last 20 years with winemakers is travel. You know, they do harvest in different parts of the world and they bounce back and forth. And by doing that, your learning curve is much shorter, it's steeper, but you pick up a lot more and you learn a lot faster. And, you know, working around the world is absolutely key. And, you know, I think that's one thing that's great about the Napa Valley is a lot of the winemakers here, there's a very international feel. There's lots of winemakers from France, Italy, Australia, New Zealand, America, and that information comes together and it means that everyone benefits and makes better and better wine.
Yeah, it is a real mixed bag out there, and my understanding for the years I've been coming out there, there is a great spirit of cooperation, again, because of the farming aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, you run into a problem, somebody can help you out possibly one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, a great example is that everyone's there to help each other. In 2011, when everybody was still picking, we'd finished. And I remember getting a call from a relatively large grower, asking if we had any picking bins because everyone was short picking bins because they were trying to pick so fast.
Sure.
I said, actually, we're done picking. How many you want?
Nice.
And they took every single one of our picking bins so they could keep picking their fruit. And, you know, it's little things like that. Like, you know, helping the guy next door is a huge thing. Like, I get phone calls all the time from other winemakers. I call other winemakers all the time. Hey, you know, I'm having this trouble. Have you dealt with this before? What are you doing? And I get heaps of phone calls. Hey, I've got this problem. What do I do? And it's, you know, everybody helps each other. And I think one way of looking at it is, if you all work together and the Napa is successful as a whole, we will all prosper. But if we all fight amongst ourselves, we will all fail. That's one thing I love about Napa is, more and more I'm seeing that the more we work together as a whole, the more Napa will prosper.
I'm sure, again, this goes back to the Mother Nature thing. You get occasional curveballs that nobody's seen before, which I'm sure happens a lot.
On a monthly basis.
Yeah, right. And it's got to be figured out. I've always admired that spirit of cooperation because in the end, you're all making wine. There's no huge secret. You might have your own technique, but you know, you're making wine.
Yeah, and we're all essentially trying to achieve the same thing. We want to make something that tastes good, that makes people happy. So, you know, the more we work together, the better it is.
I've always thought it was a good thing that people have the opinion they do of France because it makes California work really hard, and that makes it...
Yeah. All us wine drinkers.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
So it's a question I don't ask very often, but I'm a little curious about it. You know, obviously you've had 12 years in, a lot of experience there at Rombauer. Do you have any stories that are, wow, I can't believe I did that? You know, something that was just so crazy that you can't even believe it happened.
Yeah, I've got a good one, actually. You know, we played around with barrel fermenting Cabernet specifically in small French oak barrels and large French oak barrels pretty much from the first year I started here in 04. And we do it in punching, standing on their heads, and we punch it down and played around all these different ways. And chatting to other winemakers who were making some of the top wines in the Napa Valley, they were using a technique where they'd put about 400 pounds of grapes in a barrel, of red grapes, specifically Cabernet, and it'd be a French oak barrique, and then they'd roll the barrel rather than punching it down. So I started playing around looking at this, and Michel Rolland does it a lot with his wines for his personal stuff, and I really started to get interested in it. And we knew from our experience with Chardonnay, as soon as we put juice in a barrel and fermented in a barrel, especially for Chardonnay, it made it better. And we're like, well, maybe it'll work for Cabernet. So we played and played and played and played. And in 2010, I bit the bullet and I bought some equipment. I did 10 barrel ferments in small French oak barrels on these special racks where we rolled them rather than punching them down. And it was really, really, really expensive to buy all the equipment and get into it. And Colonel Rombauer had a few choice words to say to me when he saw the bill on these barrels and the equipment I was buying. I explained to him what it was for, and he sort of raised his eyebrows at me and didn't look too convinced, but he let me do it. He had trust in me to let me do it, but he definitely wasn't convinced. So harvest came and went, and in 2010 we picked about 40% of our crush in 7 days because we had incremental weather coming that was pretty poor. Mm-hmm. And the second last night of crush, we'd been at work about 20 hours. I told the guys, go get those French oak barrels. We're putting some of this spice laying cabinet. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy, but they did it anyway. I've got a great team, and I swear would follow me through the gates of hell if I told them to. And we made the wine from these 10 barrel ferments, and from every 2 barrel ferments, end up with roughly 1 barrel of wine. So I had these 5 barrels of our best Cabernet. It was 100% barrel fermented. And we're sitting down after harvest, and we were actually being filmed or interviewed, I can't remember, and I was tasting Kerner through some of these wines, and he tries this one Spice-Lane Cabernet, and he goes, what's this? I said, oh, it's that barrel fermented stuff. And he kind of looked at me funny. I said, you remember those really expensive barrels I bought and the equipment, and you kind of were not happy? He goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. He goes, this stuff tastes really good. You should do all the Cabernet like this. I swear I nearly fell off my chair. I was like, one, it was so hard to convince you, and two, do you know how much hard work it is to do barrel ferments? Now you want to do all of that Cabernet like that? So that kind of spawned a revolution in our Cabernet winemaking, and We've grown that barrel ferment program every year to now it's one of the larger ones in Napa Valley, and about half of our Cabernet is now fermented in barrel.
And are they still rolled then?
They are still rolled, yeah. So we worked on the technique for, you know, it took us about 5 years to get the technique down to where we were making wines we were happy with. And now we have an entire floor where we can do around 400 to 600 barrel ferments a harvest with just Cabernet.
That's very cool. One thing I'm curious about on barrel fermentation, and for a moment there, we talked off mic about my experience at a winery. Why is it that that's never listed on a label just as sort of a as an attribute? Because to me, for a lot of wine drinkers, barrel fermentation seems to me would make a big difference to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a great question. I don't have an answer for it. Sometimes our marketing material will list the percentage of the wine that was fermented in barrel.
Sure.
In some cases, it's, you know, with our Chardonnay, obviously, it's standard practice, but sometimes our Cabernets, some of our specialty cabs, our single vineyard cabs will be 100% barrel fermented, but we never listed it on the bottle. And I wonder as well, it's such a new technique that's, you know, really only come into its own the last probably 10, maybe 15 years, that it's maybe there's a certain amount of consumer education needs to be done before the consumer understands what it means.
That's a real good point, because you could say the same to a degree about vineyard designate, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's taken a while to come around for the consumer to understand it. I mean, the high-end wine consumer who's, you know, a real wine enthusiast and knows, you know, all the top producers in the world, of course, they're going to recognize it straight away. But for the normal person who consumes wine on a regular basis but isn't crazy about finding out everything, it might be a little more challenging. Well, it's funny because, you know, barrel ferment, like in Australia, it's very, very common to finish your red wines, finish the fermentation in barrel. So you ferment in a tank, you press it off while it's still a little bit sweet, and it finishes ferment in barrel and goes through Malo and barrel. And that's been, I mean, that was started with Max Schubert in the 50s. And it's fairly common practice in Australia. I can't say I've ever worked anywhere that doesn't do that. But then over here, they attribute that technique to Michel Rollon.
Hmm.
And I'm like, well, it's kind of standard practice in Australia, but okay. It's funny how different techniques come into fashion and vogue, and they're attributed to a certain consultant or famous winemaker, whereas if you look into it, like I'm sure people were barrel fermenting Cabernet before the latest craze of doing it. And, you know, the latest craze in Napa at the moment, not craze, but the one of the more newer techniques which people are excited about, especially winemakers, is fermenting in concrete.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking about that.
And, I mean, the first wine I worked in was Penfolds McGill, and that was all we had was concrete. We didn't have any stainless steel tanks. And that was just what we had.
But concrete goes back quite a ways, doesn't it?
Oh, and, I mean, if you look traditionally where, like, if say you go over to Bordeaux and you look at the left bank and the right bank. The left bank traditionally had oak fermenters, and the right bank around Saint-Emilion always had concrete. And, I mean, that was what was available. It wasn't, we're doing this because this makes the best wine. You know, necessity is the mother of invention. That's what was available to make fermentation vessels out of. So that's what they used.
Yeah, it wasn't about fashion. It was about getting the job done.
It was about, exactly. What's available to make this happen? In Saint-Emilion, we used concrete. In Pauillac, we used oak vats. I mean, that was just the reality.
Well, do you think that maybe nowadays, you know, there's a greater communication? Obviously, there's a wonderful communication in Napa and probably a certain amount between Napa and Sonoma. But, you know, between the United States winemakers and, say, the Finger Lakes area and then getting off to France, Australia, winemakers are talking to each other more and they're experiencing more interchange because of winemakers going to different parts of the world to work.
I think that definitely has a part of it. And I just, the understanding of wine science, you know, where it is today versus where it was 50 years ago is huge. I mean, you know, the understanding of how a technique works on a wine, the consequences of that technique in terms of flavor and aroma and texture, you know, that's come a long way from even 30, 40 years ago. And, you know, that coupled with, you know, better education, better understanding, more research, and then winemakers traveling and talking, I mean, it's just, you know, snowballed effectively and gotten faster and faster.
Sure, it's good for everybody.
Like, I love it when I have, like, a wine blind, and you're like, ooh, this tastes like an Alsace Riesling. It's, you know, it has certain characteristics that lend you to think that it's from a particular part of the world. Then you find out what it is. It's not, but that winemaker trained in that part of the world.
I didn't think about that. Good point.
And it's happened to me in blind tastings a number of times. I'm like, oh, no, this is an Alsace, or you know, this is a Burgundy, but it's from a different part of the world. But then when you look, you know, peel back the cover a little bit more, you're like, oh, well, such and such trained here or worked here for 15 years. So he knows certain techniques in the vineyard and in the winery to craft the wine in that style.
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good point, because I ran into experience a few years ago where a Napa winemaker who was from France, and she was making both her own Sauvignon Blanc as well as for the winery she worked for.
I think I know who you mean, actually. she has a Sauvignon Blanc at Premier every year. I've only met her once, but I love a Sauvignon Blanc. Yeah, but you'd swear that that's a white Bordeaux.
Totally. Well, the first time I had it, it was just had such a wonderful taste. It was completely different than anything I've had in Napa.
Yeah, because I remember it's unusual to do a Sauvignon Blanc at Premier, but every time I try, I'm like, God, I swear this is from Grave. Like, it doesn't taste like a Napa Valley Sauvignon Blanc. If I had it blind and a tasting, I wouldn't pick it.
Well, Rombauer has been around since 1980. About how many cases are you guys doing these days?
We're doing around 100,000 cases of Chardonnay, with, you know, a reserve Chardonnay and some single vineyards, and doing about 40 to 50,000 cases of red wine, depending on the vintage.
From what I've seen, Rombauer is pretty commonly available around the country.
Yeah, our Chardonnay, definitely, yeah. We're making enough to distribute nationally.
Great. It's good to see that because it's become such a well-known brand.
Problem is, I hear rumors out there, like my favorite ones, people are, oh, you're making 500,000 cases. I'm like, you know what? I wish we were.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still, like, people go, well, why can't you make more? Like, it obviously sells out every year in 9 or 10 months. Why don't you just make more? And it's taken us 35 years to get to that volume.
Yeah.
While protecting the quality. And it's not like we can just plant more vineyard and instantaneously the next year produce an extra 50,000 cases. We're very, very protective of the quality and the style of the wine. And if we get some grapes or some wine that isn't right for it, it doesn't get blended in and it won't be bottled. So that's one thing I love at Rombauer is if it's not right, I'm not forced to make a volume. I'm forced to make the best wine I can. And you know, Rombauer is very understanding. Some years we can make a little more and some years it's going to be a little less.
That's a terrific attitude. I like the idea that you said, what was it, protect the wine?
Protect the quality of the wine, not the quantity.
Yeah, that's fabulous. That alone is its own, you know, catchphrase.
Well, I remember when I took over as director of winemaking, Mr. Rombauer had a very clear message for me. He said, you can't change anything, but you have to make it better. And I was like, what the? That's like... But, you know, if you look at the consistency of our wines the last, you know, 7 years, the reviews we get, the scores across all of our wines, not just Chardonnay, you know, our Cabernet, our Merlot, our Zinfandel, we're pretty proud that we've been able to stylistically keep the wines within our style parameters, but make them better.
Mm.
And the one thing I love is when people especially try our red wines, they're almost shocked. They're like, oh, you guys make really good red wine. I'm like, well, yeah, we don't just make Chardonnay. And that's the part when I actually get to leave the winery and go out and see the public and taste them on the wines, the shock on their face when they see how good our red wines are is priceless.
That's got to make you feel pretty darn good.
It does. It makes you feel very good.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great thing about doing what you do. You get to really experience that. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had the chance to be in a restaurant and see somebody drinking the wine that you've made and sit back and go, yeah.
Oh, I'll make sure I go say hi.
Yeah, good for you.
If I see him drinking some of our Chardonnay or any one of our red wines, you know, I'm under strict instructions from Mr. Rombauer to go make sure you tell them thank you for buying your wine.
Well, what an honor that would be to have you come up to a table and say, yeah, you know, that's the stuff we make. That's pretty impressive.
It's good fun.
Yeah, I bet it is. That's very cool. One more thing I want to ask you, and that is, what do you like to drink?
What time of day? If I'm coming off a 22-hour day at the winery, it's definitely a beer.
Well, what's that old saying? Takes a lot of beer to make good wine, right?
Yeah, that's the saying. Yeah, it definitely does. It really, at the moment, you know, we just bottled our Sauvignon Blanc, which is the second vintage we've ever made of Sauvignon Blanc. And so last week I was frantically tasting through Sauvignon Blancs from around the world to see how I stacked up. I wouldn't say I'm fussy in terms of what it is, just so long as it's high quality. And, you know, the week before that, I was drinking Australian wine. The week before last, it was Italian wine. I mean, I just like to taste as much as I can of everything I can.
Well, it's kind of exciting when you crack a bottle of something you've never had.
Oh, that's the best part. Yeah. Me and my wife went out to dinner last week, and we're in a restaurant, and they had an excellent bite of glass wine list, wines from around the world. They had a, you know, they even had a red wine from Lebanon, which I think I must have had a red wine from Lebanon maybe once in my life before. Mm-hmm. And I was just going down the wine list saying, can I just have a half glass of this and a half glass of that? Just because I wanted to try all these different wines they had.
Yeah.
And it was great. The staff were awesome. They were like, absolutely.
Well, the cool thing is about it is they're going to learn from you, too, because maybe I'm sure they've got to try some of these. But I have never tried Lebanese wine, so what did you think of it?
It was really, really good. I can't remember the name of it. I took a photo of the bottle, but, yeah, I was like, wow, that's an experience. I have guys from around the world that come do harvest for us. And this year we had guys from Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Spain, Italy, South Africa, can't remember where else. Greece, that was what it was. And so at the start of harvest, I told them all, you know, you're coming to work here for harvest, bring a bottle of your favorite wine from your home country. And it was a great tasting. I mean, it was phenomenally good fun. And what was surprising was the white wine from Greece was probably the best wine of the tasting.
Was it really?
But I'd never thought of, like, Greece making world-class white wine. So it was a real eye-opener.
I think that's where the world is going. I mean, a lot of areas are making really, really good wine. And that, of course, forces you guys to work even harder.
Yep.
That's a great idea. I hope I get to try your Sauvignon Blanc one day. It'd be kind of fun to try it, being it was only 2 years that you've been into it, because I love Sauvignon Blanc. I don't drink a lot of it, but I do love it.
It was very carefully thought out. It took me it was 5 years of planning before we made one, to find the right vineyards and convince the Ron Bowers that we could do it and do it well. And last year we made about 1,500 cases, and this year we've gone up to about 6,000 cases. And it'll be nationally distributed in very, very small amounts starting in February next year. And we're very, very proud of it, like ridiculously proud of it.
I can tell.
The feedback has been crazy. But like everything we do at Rombauer, we're not going to make huge amounts of it unless we're confident we can maintain the quality and the style that we've set for ourselves.
Sure. That's a great attitude. Richie, for our listeners who would like to learn a little bit about Rombauer, and just as a quick aside before I forget, you are by appointment, or can people just come by?
We by appointment only. That's pretty much due to our popularity. So you can get on our website at rombauer.com and make an appointment there, or you can phone the winery. Yeah, we are by appointment only.
Excellent, as it should be, because I think that's a more personalized experience. Richie, I got to say, this has been a really enjoyable and entertaining interview. You're just a great guy to talk to, and I hope we do get to meet face-to-face real soon.
That'd be great. Well, if next time you're in Napa, you know, give me a call and you don't have to make an appointment.
I will do that, I promise you. Richie, thanks very much. Appreciate you taking the time, and, you know, I hope you have a great 2016 as well.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Learn more by visiting rombauer.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2015.